welcome friends from around the world. Thank you for tuning in today. Nice to talk with you. I hope you're doing well. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, Scandinavia. And on our website, redicecreations.com, you can find all our previous radio shows. We have well over a year of radio shows available for free. We are also doing some much-needed maintenance and update of our news section at the moment. We had a few database issues that arose due to this, so we'll have our news back up and running here as soon as possible. So thank you for your patience on that, by the way. For the full broadcast and all previous shows, go to redeyesmembers.com. You can sign up for membership and dive into our archives right there. Today we have a new guest for you. Andrei Znamensky is with us. He has studied history and anthropology both in Russia and the United States. Formerly a resident scholar at the Library of Congress, then a foreign visiting professor at Hokkaido University in Japan. He has taught various courses at the University of Toledo, Ohio, Alabama State University, and the University of Memphis. Among them are world civilizations, Russian history, and the history of religions. His major field of interests include shamanism, the history of Western esotericism, and Russian history, as well as religions of Siberia and North America. Znamensky lived and traveled extensively in Alaska, Siberia, and Japan. At one point, he became intrigued with the fact that shamanism and tribal spirituality became so popular with Western spiritual seekers since the 1960s. Today our topic is Red Shambhala, the dark side of Tibetan Buddhism. Few may know the role that Shambhala played in Russian geopolitics in the early 20th century, leading to the horrors of the Soviet Union. Znamensky's book presents a completely different view of early Soviet history. Using archival sources and memoirs, he explored how spiritual adventurers and revolutionaries West and East exploited Shambhala to promote their fanatical schemes, focusing on the Bolshevik attempts to use Mongol-Tibetan prophecies to railroad communism into Inner Asia. We also talk about the obsession with the despise for the Western tradition. Later we discuss Nicholas Roerich, Helena Roerich, Theosophy, Henry Wallace, FDR, and his New Deal, and how the all-seeing eye in the pyramid ended up on the dollar bill. It's all connected. And welcome, Andrei. Thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me at your show.
You bet. You've been involved in a lot of different academic work and research studies in world history, religions, Western shamanism, etc. A lot of things, under your belt in that regard. What is something in your Russian background, Andrei, that led you to studying, Roerich and eventually writing Red Shambhala?
Well, my first PhD was in the history of Native Americans, history of religions, and that's how I gradually drifted into Roerich and history of religions, cultural history, counterculture. When I moved here in 1991, I did my PhD on Russian missionaries among the Native American Indians in Alaska, and which eventually took me to shamanism and the New Age, because when I was doing research in Alaska among the Athabascan Indians in Anchorage, I met two Caucasians. One was, she was a nurse, and another guy, he was a real estate broker. And he claimed that he was a former alcoholic. So both of them were interested in neo-shamanism, paganism. So that's another thing, that I became interested in the Western New Age, neo-shamanism, and wrote a book about it, which is called The Beauty of the Primitive, Shamanism and the Western Imagination. And you know what? When I was writing this book, something struck me. I noticed that since 1960s, for you, of course, it's not a revelation, it's not news, but for me at that time it was a new thing. I noticed it's what like a thread goes through the minds of all the people whom I interviewed for my research, is this despise for the Western culture and Western civilization,
right,
and obsession,
yeah,
with non-Western tradition. Okay.
Yeah.
So I decided to look into this, and that's what materialized in the beauty of the primitive. And when I was done with this book, I shifted to Tibetan Buddhism. I became interested in what fascinated Westerners in Tibetan Buddhism, working along the same lines. So I started exploring how Westerners became interested in these romantic images of Shambhala, this Tibetan Buddhist prophecy, Shangri-La, Tibetan Buddhism in general. And I had some answers to this question. So eventually I wrote the book, Red Shambhala. It's a story about how essentially people on the left became interested in Tibetan Buddhist prophecies, because we have a bunch of stuff written about a fascination in Tibetan Buddhist prophecies on the part of so-called right-wing people. And nobody paid attention that there was a similar trend on the left. In fact, right now it's even more so, because right now New Age, American Tibetan Buddhism is something that is more embraced by people on the left, on the left liberal.
That's right,
on so-called the right. You know? It's another interesting thing. You know, whatever was popular among the people on the right in 1920s, 1930s, now became the kind of cultural icon for people on the left.
Very interesting. Now, let's break down some of the terms here. I think most of people are already, who listen to this, are familiar with, Shambhala, Shangri-La, some of these kind of more, some of those principles. But let's just cover that a little bit before we dive into the details of that. What is Shambhala?
Shambhala, it's actually a Tibetan Buddhist prophecy, a Buddhist paradise. But we have to keep in mind that in original Buddhism, there was no concept of paradise. So the Shambhala prophecy, and Shambhala is a Tibetan Buddhist paradise. This legend was created in early Middle Ages, between 600 and 900 AD, when Tibetan Buddhist world was fighting against the Muslim invasions in northern India, in the Himalayan areas. During this time, during the time of this jihad, Islamic jihad, as a counter, to counter Muslim invasions, Buddhist people created their own Buddhist jihad, so to speak. Buddhist.
Really? Wow.
Well, we were right. You're right. It's a concept of this Buddhist paradise that you have to understand that at that time, Buddhism was literally besieged by Muslims all over, and it was hard for them to resist against Muslims, because Islam is a pretty simple religion, especially easy to embrace for people with elementary education. If
right.
Islam competes with Buddhism, Buddhism normally loses, because to embrace Buddhism, you have to,
have to
be
think
more
a little bit, maybe.
Yeah. It's not so simple.
That's
eventually
funny.
Yeah, Buddhists created this legend about Buddhist paradise, and basically a rallying call to fight against Muslim invasions. The concept is very simple. Okay, so they try to simplify the whole message of Buddhism in order to draw Buddhists to their side. That the legend said that at a certain point, once upon a time, there would be a tragedy for the world of Buddhism, that the world of Buddhism would be besieged by infidels, so-called people of Malacca, or people of Mecca, in other words. And at one point, the king of Shambhala, glorious king, Rudra Chakran, would come and save the Tibetan Buddhist people from the infidels. So he will come with the powerful army of warriors, with thousands of elephants, with the thousands of warriors, and would destroy the completely the enemies of the true faith, and the new world would prevail, the world of Buddhism and infidels would be gone, and the whole world would be Tibetan Buddhist. Okay, so we have to keep in mind that this prophecy in early Middle Ages and later was reinvoked by Mongols and Tibetans each time when they were threatened by foreign invaders. Okay, another interesting thing. like in Islam, Shambhala has two dimensions. Okay, remember in Islam, there is internal jihad and external jihad. The same thing in Tibetan Buddhism. There is exterior Shambhala and internal Shambhala. Okay. The exterior, it's a fight against the enemies of the faith who attack the faith. And internal, it's a fight against your own internal demons. Okay, right. And that's what present-day Tibetan Buddhists prophesize. They claim that Shambhala war, it's not something like a real war. It's a fight against your internal demons. And we have to give credit to Tibetan Buddhists compared to Muslims, they were able to adjust themselves to the modern times, you know, so I hope the Muslims would follow the suit, you know, at least it will make it easy for us.
Right, right. So was their tactic of simplification a success in a way then, right?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. If you, for instance, go to a New Age section in bookstores, you will see a bunch of books on Shambhala war, and it's only about this internal Shambhala. It's about fight against your internal demons, internal temptations, that basically you have to be a good person and so forth and so forth. Another thing we have to keep in mind that Shambhala is actually part of a broad teaching called Kalachakra Tantra, okay? Kalachakra Tantra, it's a bunch of Tibetan Buddhist teachings that are designed to perfect your mind, your body, and that's where we have a lot of controversy because there is a bunch of questionable practices here, like related to sexuality, kind of misogynism, and all these things. Okay.
Interesting. Tell us a bit more about that in terms, I don't think a lot of people know about those particular practices. Many people today have a very, I guess, simplified version of what Buddhism is in their head as well. It's one that, of course, as you pointed out before, a lot of Westerners has embraced for some interesting reason. So tell us a little bit more about the dark side of Tibetan Buddhism.
It's an interesting question because Tibetan Buddhists, of course, for obvious reasons, they don't like to talk about the dark sides. And there is another issue here that since Tibet had become a relatively early, the object of Chinese attacks, and in modern times was the object of attacks on the part of Chinese communists, there was a huge sympathy for the plight of Tibetans, you know, and you know the story, you know, if people are declared victims, so you're not supposed to criticize them.
That's right.
So that's the issue. So in this case, as soon as you try to bring up the dark sides of Tibetan Buddhism, you immediately label the Chinese agent, the Chinese communist. So it happened with me, like when during the visit of Dalai Lama to Washington, D.C., he was performing a mass Kalachakra initiation. So thousands of people in Washington, D.C. in 2011. And I posted the Huffington Post note about the origin of Kalachakra, trying to alert people that originally it was a male-oriented technique that take advantage of female concerts, you know, to empower male monks.
Right.
So this practice originally had nothing to do with peace and tolerance. That's what they, that's how they labeled this Kalachakra teaching. And I was immediately attacked and labeled as a Chinese agent, a Chinese communist, you know, one lady even said, how can I teach in American college when I talk bad things about Tibetan Buddhists? So you're not supposed, yeah. Like, yeah, you're not supposed. It's the best religion. That's what it makes difficult to talk about Tibetan Buddhism, because it's like religion that is beyond you're not supposed to attack, because it's religion of the victims, and plus it's the most humanistic religion. And Dalai Lama, he plugged himself well into this victimhood, and of course he tries to empower Tibetan community. And the story is spread that Tibetan Buddhism, it's a scientific religion. It's the most ecumenical religion. And recently he added another thing, you know, I guess to kind of combat this criticism, that it's the most female-oriented religion.
Oh, really?
Environmental religion.
Is trying to capitalize on the issue here. Well, this is interesting and very much a contradiction in my terms then, because what I remember is an article out of, was it the Australian, I guess it's just news out of Australia, online journal, back in 2010, interview with that particular magazine. He declared that he's a Marxist. He said he agrees that capitalism had helped China to a certain extent, but he said that he had Marxist leanings. How do we explain that contradiction?
Well, a few times, actually, Dalai Lama claimed that I think the Marxism is good, you know, because it preaches the spread of the wealth, you know. He blamed Chinese communists, but at the same time, he said the original message was good. And my suspicion is that he's a very shrewd diplomat, so I think he might have wanted to cater to the interests of his Western supporters, because a lot of the Marxists, they have the soft spot for socialism, so he didn't want to be harsh on Marxism. So
oh,
that's it's my speculation.
Yeah. Well, that explains it, because it's obviously a very it's very trendy these days. I mean, not only, of course, among younger people. I mean, it's popular among older people too. But it's kind of in academic circles. It's the thing to be, right? Otherwise, you're pretty much kicked out of wherever you have tenure. You know.
Yeah, yeah. It's we have people, professors at colleges who invite Buddhist monks to the classes left and right. There's nothing wrong with this, you know, as long as we have this balance, inviting people from the other denominations, you know. But
is there balance?
Yeah, yeah. I don't care too much about Christians either, you know.
Right. Yeah.
I'm pretty much an open-minded person, you know. But it's always I noticed this trend, you know, the sympathies are always tilted toward the non-Western people, you know?
Yes.
It's like, for instance, a pure obsession recently that claiming that Tibetan Buddhism from early on was the most peaceful religion, you know, that's, I have issues with this. For example, if you go back into history, you will see that in Middle Ages and early modern times, the Dalai Lama predecessors of present-day Dalai Lama, they never preached peace, you know. In fact, what they tried to refurbish into their peaceful doctrine was the doctrine of compassion, which was understood in traditional Tibetan Buddhism as a compassion on the part of the bodhisattvas, as the Buddhist saints, you know, who tried to convince people to go back to the true faith, to Buddhism, okay? So that's what they tried to do, through compassion, through persuasion. And in fact, if needed, they even could do compassionate murder, you know, if it was needed for the sake of the faith, you know, because the goal was to do everything good for their own faith, okay? If it worked for Tibetan Buddhism, it was accepted, you know. If something was useful to propagate, to spread around the faith, that was acceptable. So it was not the doctrine of this ecumenical peace to be open to all other faiths. The modern-day concept of nonviolence actually was picked up by Dalai Lama, present-day Dalai Lama, from Gandhi, from Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right.
So before, for instance, his predecessor, the 13th Dalai Lama, he never knew about so-called ahimsa. It's a Hindu concept of nonviolence. And there was a funny incident when Mahatma Gandhi once wrote a letter to the 13th Dalai Lama and told him, so, "We hope you stick to ahimsa, the doctrine of nonviolence," because Gandhi didn't know too much about Tibetan Buddhism. And the Dalai Lama, the predecessor of present-day Dalai Lama, responded to him in a letter, "What are you talking about? So we are not familiar with this nonviolence." So it was miscommunication. The present-day Dalai Lama, he simply plugged himself into this Western humanism, human rights doctrine, tried to... it's a strategy of survival, which is understandable, which is part of Tibetan tradition, too. Okay.
Right.
For example, in Tibetan Buddhism, there is a long tradition of looking for a good sponsorship, you know, from early on, since the time of Mongol Khans, Dalai Lama were looking for powerful patrons, you know, in order to spread Tibetan Buddhism. So the Dalai Lama simply follows tradition of looking for powerful sponsors.
So is this still an objective to actually conquer the world ideologically, philosophically, or I guess religiously to that extent? But this is, I mean, I refrain from using the word propaganda, but shall we say public relations to actually adopt these means that are popular today, like, you know, peace and love and understanding and all that?
I don't think about that the goal was conquering the world. And it's just simply, as I said, a strategy of survival, because Tibetan community in the West, they had a certain agenda to generate support for their cause, okay? And China, which we cannot exonerate China, of course, but they heavily assimilated Tibet by these days. How many years have since 1959? So they heavily assimilated Tibet. So right now, for instance, it's hard for me to imagine how the Dalai Lama can come back to China or how Tibet can become independent. So there is a certain cause among the Western Tibetan Buddhists that acquired the life of its own, okay? And they have to support this cause. There are a lot of institutions. There is a certain structure, you know. The Dalai Lama has the government in exile in Dharamsala in northern India. It's a huge structure. So it's already acquired the life of its own. So the interesting is supporting the structure, the culture, all these institutions, Tibetan Buddhist centers in Europe, in the United States, monks, you know. So there are a lot of money involved here, you know. So it's, you know, each bureaucratic institution, and religion is a bureaucratic institution.
Yeah.
needs support, and it acquires life of its own, and you cannot stop it, you know. So, and I don't think that there's some goal to conquer the world, you know. It's a simply a religion, Tibetan Buddhist in the West, that right now exists on its own with its own institution. It's like Catholic Church, you know, for instance, also.
Well, exactly. And I guess I didn't mean to exaggerate the terminology in that regard, but obviously any institution that are interested in its survival would obviously benefit immensely the more and more people who were involved in their ideology and shared their religious belief, right? So it could be basically that they hold this idea that if we can spread it further, if we can make
right.
Tibetan Buddhism to take over the world in that regard, ideologically, then why not, right? The West is really onto it right now, and it might spread further than that. Huh?
Exactly, to push further as much as possible, you know. What surprises me, talking about these double standards, okay, that's the major issue here. For example,
yeah.
If we talk about... abuse, sexual abuse in Catholic Church by Catholic priests, it's all over the media, right? But did you read about the similar things among Tibetan Buddhists? No. There's hardly any talk about it. You know? That's where the problems start, you know? So I guess the person who claims to be a humanist, you know, who defends human rights and individual freedom, he or she, they should talk openly about these things, you know. So far, I see this obvious bias in favor of non-Western religions, in this case, Tibetan Buddhism. Even in Islam, where some Western sympathizers cannot, of course, deny this anti-humanistic trend, you know. So
sure, yeah.
Admit it.
Yeah.
So they do admit it. But in case of Tibetan Buddhists, we don't have this open conversation about it. Okay.
Well, ain't that the truth? You know, double standards and censorship because it's inconvenient. And I think people also enjoy the allegiances that they can pledge towards these underdogs, if you will. And
yeah.
it's kind of a guilt association with it as well, right? That it's, oh, my God, they're, you know, just because they've been pushed into a corner by China, for example, nothing they do can be wrong, right?
Exactly. It's the same story, for instance, with any other so-called tribal minority religions, like take Native Americans in the United States. It's the same story. You know, where is this fascination with tribal religions? It's a lost cause, you know. It's Scottish Highlanders, you know.
Right.
What I would like to mention, I asked myself, what is this interest? Why is this wide interest among Western educated elite in Tibetan Buddhism? Okay.
Yeah.
We do see some marginal interests in Islam among Westerners. Some kind of kids want to be alternative, you know, okay, it's criticized, I'm going to pick up these ideas, you know, and all this stuff. But it's a marginal phenomenon. But as far as Tibetan Buddhism, it's a pretty wide phenomenon. So we have a huge chunk of Western educated segment who are embracing Tibetan Buddhism. In fact, according to statistics, in North America, 3 million people, Caucasians, WASPs, they consider themselves Tibetan Buddhists. And I asked myself, what is the reason? And again, it's my speculation. I think it's, on the one hand, it's a frustration about Western mainstream religions that started in the 1960s, like, let's call them corporate religions, like a Catholic Church and Presbyterian Church and so forth.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's where Tibetan Buddhism stepped in, okay, because in Tibetan Buddhism, we have this individualized approach, like guru principle. Okay, when you have an individual guru working with you individually, okay, you're not part of the crowd. Like when you come to a Catholic Church, you are part of this crowd. You have to stand and be part of the crowd. You have to listen to what the priest has to say. You know, here it's a little bit different. So basically, it's one-to-one communication, okay? And that's what, I guess, attracts Western Bohemians and Tibetan Buddhists, that it's an individualized religion, okay? So right. We have this guru principle where Lama, priest, approaches you and works with your mind on an individual basis, okay? It purifies your mind. And that's where it becomes tricky because this guru principle requires of your personal obedience to a particular guru, you know, who yep. cleanses your mind, cleanses your conscience, and basically the goal is for you to embrace a particular Tibetan Buddhist deity, to fill the void in your mind with the Tibetan Buddhist deity, okay? And whatever is filled, you know, it's up to the guru to decide, you know, that's where we have this danger, I guess, individual totalitarianism, let's call it this, individualized totalitarianism.
Right. Well,
it's a therapeutic, it's a sea in the age of welfare, therapeutic state, you know, Tibetan Buddhism works well, and it plugged itself in this Western therapeutic state, and it's a very powerful spiritual technique.
Indeed. Now, before we move on further and talk about the implementation of this as it begins to join with other ideologies in terms of, you know, geopolitical utopia, kind of, you know, these kinds of ideas specifically, then we'll switch over and look at the Soviet application of this. But if there's anything else we should know, you think, in terms of the dark side of Tibetan Buddhism, I think the Jiao Lama is an, the avenging Lama, fond of spilling blood during his tantric rituals, things like that.
Yeah, it's the name you mentioned is Jiao Lama. It's let's use it as a transition to this conversation about my book, Red Shamble. It was a Mongol a national liberation hero who was not a Mongol by origins. He was a Kalmyk. Kalmyk, it's a small indigenous group in the Volga River area. It's in Ural Mountain. So he came to Mongolia and put himself in charge of a national liberation movement in Western Mongolia. He used some Tibetan Buddhist rituals to empower himself and he adopted them literally. See, in the Tibetan Buddhism rituals, you can use them literally or you can use them symbolically. So it's up to you to decide. The same thing like with sexual techniques, you know, during this high initiation, during Kalachakra Tantra. So you can do it symbolically or you can do it literally, you know, with the female consorts. So Dalai Lama was using some blood rituals. He declared himself the reincarnation of Mahakal. It's one of the dark deities in Tibetan Buddhism, protector of Tibetan Buddhist faith. You know, so he claimed that he was reincarnation of Mahakal. And he used this image to kind of intimidate his competitors in Mongolia in 1910s and 1920s.
Okay, well, that's very interesting. Before we leave the topic a little bit more here, I wanted to ask you more about what you think lies behind the obsession with the despise for Western tradition and heritage at this moment. I mean, I think as well it has something to do with a religious and a spiritual void as well within the left that has taken over so much, and also maybe that's why there is an attraction towards things like Buddhism. And it's always easy, of course, to look, you know, the grass is always greener, you know, on the other side, right? You always look out there instead of actually examining what you have in your own backyard, correct?
Correct. See, let's talk about this more before we completely switch to my book, Red Shambhala, because you raised a very interesting issue that there's certain ideological void and spiritual void on the part of the left. When the powerful ideological trends exhausted themselves by 1960s, 1970s, that's when we have this revival of attention on the part of the left, you know, to the New Age, to irrationalism, Tibetan Buddhism. And I think it's a part of this, I have to use this word, the reactionary nature of the left, because being devoid of this quote-unquote progressive causes, you know, they started to plug themselves into this nationalistic cause, New Age causes, Tibetan Buddhism, by using the non-Western cultures. So it was a desperate quest for a new ideological techniques, for new ideological leverages that could be used to attack capitalism. Okay, so it was natural, and I think we need to have a special conversation about it because it's a very interesting theme. It's a separate thing, you know, because in 1930s, 1940s, we have still powerful attraction to socialism, communism, this scientific engineering. And then in the 1960s, we have this huge time landmark when this socialism, communism, this fascination with science, these things, they go down, okay? And that's when we have on the part of the left this tectonic shift toward spiritualism, irrationalism, embracement of non-Western people, like the third world as the new class to replace the working class people, okay? But talking about my book, we have a few individuals already in 1920s, 1930s, who tried to play this game. It was not popular yet at that time, okay? So we have some marginal characters in the Soviet Union, for instance, and the Wallace, Henry Wallace in the United States. They were like forerunners of these dominant trends that became powerful in our days, okay, 1960s, 1970s. So the characters I describe in my book, they were pretty marginal characters at that time, okay? They were like, I repeat, forerunners of what we have today. Like, if you take Rory, if you take Gleb Borke, you know, who tried this Bolshevik secret police officer who tried to experiment, to merge Tibetan Buddhism and communism, okay, or Henry Wallace, who tried to merge indigenous American progressivism with Tibetan Buddhism, okay, or Rory, who tried to merge this cooperative movement theosophy with Tibetan Buddhism. So these were marginal at that And yet, you know, so now we have this as a powerful mainstream trend. Okay, that I would like you to see this.
Mm-hmm. It's a very good point, and I think let's kind of break it up here a little bit. We talk about the various factions here and move across the different countries. What if we begin to talk a little bit? We've talked before about Henry Wallace and Nicholas Roerich and that connection as well, but let's focus a little bit more about what happened in the Soviet Union at this time as well, and how this was being used, you know, the ideas of utopianism, of creating a new perfect world, etc. What kind of spiritual components was merged within that ideology with Tibetan Buddhism?
You have to keep in mind that in 1920s, when the Bolsheviks did not yet completely impose control of the Soviet Union, there was a bunch of experiments running all over the country, all kinds of left groups, anarchist groups that are, to some extent, reminds me of the cultural scene in the United States in the 1960s. We have a bunch of these crazy leftists running around experimenting, avant-garde. So that's the that's the background,
right? Yeah.
For these experiments. So this two chapters from my book deal with this interesting character, Gleb Boki, who was in charge of a special section of the Soviet secret police. He was the one who experimented with these techniques, you know. He became a partner with the St. Petersburg writer Alexander Barchenko, so they tried to see what they can find in Tibetan Buddhism, what spiritual techniques they could, which they could use for mind bending, okay, to bend the minds of people in the favor of communism, okay. Yeah, it was, and I repeat, it was pretty marginal for that time. It wasn't mainstream, you know. No wonder that in 1930s they were totally eliminated by Stalin, because it was not their time, you know.
Right.
At that time, I want to emphasize, it was the time of what, three things, the state, science, and collectivism. You know, so there was not much room for this. But still, we have to talk about it, because these attempts were made, which nowadays became mainstream. So Gleb Boki, Alexander Barchenko, they tried to organize expedition to Tibet to retrieve these techniques, okay, and to use them to build communism, because the major goal was to kind of humanize the message of communism. They were so upset that there was so much blood, this Russian civil war, that maybe we can bring up Tibetan Buddhism to humanize somehow the message of communism.
Wow. Wow.
On the and the practical application also, we have to talk about Bolsheviks at that time in 1920s, using Shambhala prophecy and other Tibetan Buddhist prophecies to propagate the message of communism among illiterate shepherds of Mongolia and Tibet and Western China. Okay, so how could you spread the message of communism among the illiterate people? Okay,
right.
So
right.
The Bolsheviks, who failed in the West, they failed. Remember, the original slogan was to spread around this revolutionary Holocaust, this world revolution all over the world, especially to Europe. And when it did not materialize in the early 1920s, so they turned to the East. Okay, the Communist International turned to the East to Central Asian countries, and particularly to Mongolia. And Mongolia actually was the only country where Bolshevik was successful, because the message of communism could not spread outside of the Soviet Union at that time, 1920s, 1930s, except Mongolia. So that's where they used Tibetan Buddhist prophecy of Shambhala, trying to link message of communism to Shambhala by telling Mongol nomads, for instance, look, guys, Lenin is the king of Shambhala, okay, and the communism is the fulfillment of the Shambhal process. It's a Tibetan Buddhist paradise. So they could not latch on. They tried to find what class of people they could use to kind of peddle the message of communism.
Yeah.
And it's funny that there was no working class there, and they tried to work with this these illiterate nomads who sometimes simply couldn't understand them. So eventually Bolsheviks came to the conclusion that the only class of people in Mongolia, in Tibet, with whom they could work were junior lamas. You know? They said junior lamas, they should be treated as proletarians, you know, because they were abused by big, rich lamas. You know?
Wow,
so,
really?
That was the message of Comintern, Communist International,
yep.
in early 1920s, to go to Mongolia and further to Tibet to instigate these junior lamas against senior lamas, you know.
Jeez.
Wow. To revolt against exploiters, and that's how they tried to bring communism to Mongolia and to Tibet.
Now, were there any, as far as you're concerned, mergers with this later, this idea of just creating, I mean, a lot of it lays it out, of course, in Marxism in itself, but you have a lot of different flavors to this later, you know, Marxist Leninism, and, you know, Stalin comes into the picture later, but were any of these religious ideas of creating a basically a place that doesn't exist on the earth with the aid of communism, but they used this kind of spiritual flavor to get the message through, even to the Russian people, perhaps?
Absolutely, absolutely. A very important question, by the way. You hit the nail on the spot, so to speak.
Good.
It's, we shouldn't forget that communism and socialism, too, they have a powerful religious component.
Yep, very much so.
For example, students, when I teach my classes about world history or Russian history, other courses, students ask me, why did communism and socialism became so popular? Okay, and I said, here is the explanation, because communism slash socialism, they had a powerful religious component. Not only in Mongolia and these third world countries, where I think communism and socialism was embraced pretty much for this reason, but also in European countries, where some, not everybody, you know, but some large segments of population embraced socialism for the same reasons. Look at this 19th century when Marxism comes to the picture. What was it in Germany and Western Europe? It was the time of Industrial Revolution, when we have a bunch of peasants with elementary education, some of them illiterate, some of them with elementary education, coming from the countryside to the cities. Okay, the science becomes, elementary science becomes popular, so it captivates minds of the people. So so-called educated folks come to the picture, okay, who also embrace the science. Traditional religion goes down, and I'm talking about Europe right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Here we have Karl Marx coming with his powerful prophecy, okay, and it's a prophecy that has two parts, scientific part and religious part. The scientific part tells that there are certain stages in development of the people, okay. When workers come together, they develop this collective mentality. There are certain laws of evolution which tell us that people would develop from elementary stage to high stage capitalism, and eventually science tells us the revolt would happen, and capitalism creates its own grave diggers, and workers come and take over power. Okay, that's the scientific part. See, we have social evolution, which resonated well with people who had elementary education. So here's the science, okay, who didn't like mainstream religion. But at the same time, they were still people of religion, you know. They still needed some religion. People, even those who rejected the religion, they still carried this religious mentality.
Exactly.
But the religious part, that's when the religious part stepped in, you know. So Karl Marx prophesied that would be this golden paradise, you know, this quote-unquote communist shamble. That time would come, you know, the time of judgment, when the poor people would phase out the rich people, and then golden age would come, when women and men would be equal, when people would be brothers and sisters, when there would be no money, no market, you know, and everybody would live in peace, you know. That's no wonder it resonated with people. That's how we have millions of people embracing this message, you know. That is why I have sometimes arguments with some of my conservative friends, you know, who are like criticize communism, socialism, and I agree with some of the critique, but at the same time,
sure,
I tell them, hey guys, let's understand why this collectivism, this version of collectivism, captivated the minds of the millions of people, okay, all over the world.
Yeah.
You know, and the explanation is that communism and socialism was a secular religion customized for the time of modernization. No wonder we have socialism and communism becoming so popular among non-Western countries, which modernize themselves. It's the same thing, you know. A traditional religion is on decline. At the same time, people need some kind of ideology, so that's where we have communism / socialism stepping in, filling this void. It's scientific enough.
Exactly. That's a very good point. And also note the language that good old Charlie Marx uses and how he describes it as it's already a fact. It's just a matter of time. In other words, it is a religious prophecy. It's a message. It's a new message for a new age where the world is changing so quickly with the industrialization and everything that people is looking for some kind of stability. And here's a guy who, you know, on the surface perhaps of things, if you don't study it in greater detail, like, wow, this sounds pretty good, right? Is there relation? You can relate to it because of your situation alone, right? And you don't really maybe understand the macro version or the larger picture in this regard. So it works just like a religion. I think that's a very important point.
Yeah, it's like a spiritual anchor. I remember a long time ago, when 30 years, I had the teacher of. In Soviet Union, there was a discipline called scientific communism, so I had to go through this hell, you know, to study this discipline. And the professor who was teaching this discipline, he kept repeating. He said, guys, you have a powerful spiritual anchor, you know, don't think too much about the facts. You have a powerful theory, you know. The facts will come and they will fit in, you know, as long as you don't forget the theory. So it's a perfect, it's like a priest, you know, coming to the podium and telling this the flock, you know.
Well, I mean, here we are laughing, but let's not forget how many millions, tens of, you know, millions of people that died under this ideology.
Yeah, yeah.
It's,
well,
it's,
you know, the
it's
same
a horror.
Thing.
It's a nightmare.
That's true. More than, I guess, during religious wars in early modern Europe, you
yep,
know.
That's
remember
right.
Religious wars, between fights between Catholics and Protestants. Similar story, the form was different, but the essence was the same, essentially. Huh?
Yeah, I know. What were you doing in this time during Russia? How did you get out? Did you flee? What happened to you?
Well, to be honest, I I want to share with you a story, but it doesn't fit exactly our narrative. You know, since 1978, I actually wanted to get out from the Soviet Union. I had this small incident, and it kind of had a profound influence on me. I was dreaming about becoming a historian since I was in the sixth grade, and in 1978, I tried to enter a college, and education was for free. Of course, when it's for free, the competition is high, bribes and everything. But I thought I was quite qualified, and I was flunked, you know, even though I passed all my exams, and later I realized that my last name, Znamensky, sounded Jewish to them, you know, so they considered me to be a Jew, and at that time in 1978 there was an unspoken quota, you know, in the Soviet Union not to pick up too many Jews, you know, even though I was not a Jew, you know, so I became a victim of this campaign, you know, and I became interested in the Jewish culture, you know. I started to read about it, and then eventually I started exploring this Marxist-Leninism, the whole message, and became frustrated about the whole the secular religion of Marxism. So it alienated me. And even though I later entered this Soviet college, I did not totally buy the whole thing they were telling me. And I actually lived a double life. You know, I was talking during the daylight, you know, whatever they required from me in the college, you know, to get good grades. But when I came home, I was reading my books and I was contemplating my own articles. You know, I started writing stories, essays. You know, as soon as I had a chance in 1991, I moved to the world. Just to do my second PhD, and I was doing it in a history of religions. That's the story.
Wow! Right. Well, that's very interesting, and it's that's a strange kind of you know, story as well in terms of how that unfolded in a way. But you lived through that horror and terror. In other words,
As I said, I became this victim of this kind of reverse affirmative action.
I was just going to say, it's like affirmative action.
In Soviet Union,
but isn't that bizarre though? Because I mean, there were so many Jewish people on, you know, in terms of running the Bolshevik Revolution and everything there. I've heard.
In the beginning, it was the case, you know, which, it's just, we need to, probably have a separate show about it, you know.
I think we should.
I researched this, you know, there's no need to go into conspiracy theories about it. It's a pretty obvious why it happened, how it happened, you know. You have a group of marginalized people who plugged himself into this, the cosmopolitan cores, you know, because if I live in diaspora, you know, I can't latch on indigenous nationalism. So naturally I become an internationalist, a cosmopolitan. So if I have around me this ideology that says that workers of the world don't have motherland, the fatherland, of course, I embrace this ideology. It's a natural thing, you know. But the story is that, and that is why I have problems with these conspiracy clips that all over YouTube, is that Stalin in 1930s, he eliminated all these people, you know, because Stalin peddled his own version of national Bolshevism. He tried to blend Soviet Marxism with Russian nationalism. So these cosmopolitan people, you know. Diaspora, I call them diaspora people, the Poles, Jews, Lithuanians, Greeks, you know, they were out of the picture. So they were physically phased out, you know. So by 1940s, 1950s, there were hardly any diaspora people left in the Soviet elite. It was the Slavic, Russian, Ukrainian people, you know. That's, there's a lot of research on this. But I guess it kind of takes us away from our theme. You know?
Exactly. I think we should wrap things up with the first segment on that note, because it's just interesting to hear a little bit about your personal story there, of course. But why don't we, I'm just giving out some of the details here of where people can find more you know, about your work and such. Obviously, the book Red Shambhala, that's the title, and people can pick it up on Amazon, of course. And do you have a personal website?
I don't have a personal website, but I have a YouTube channel. It's called Magus West. It's the same word, you know, Magus West, okay, or Magus West. So there you can see some video trailers, some of the chapters from this book, Red Shambhala, my talks at the conferences, okay, and actually talks about Nicholas Roerich and Henry Wallace, whom I tried to put in this historical context of the 1930s and 1920s.
Yeah, definitely. I want to talk more about that in the second segment here. Roerich, Wallace, FDR, the New Deal, and how basically this is a something that was implemented very much the same ideology on different places on the world at the same time there. So we'll get into more of that and of more of Red Shambhala as well in the second. In the meantime, then youtube.com/Magus West. We're going to have that linked up on redicecreations.com as well. All right, stay with us, Andre. We'll be right back with more.
Wash away my trouble. Wash away my pain. With the rain and Shambhala. Wash away.
second hour, we discuss more about the wild fantasies of the collectivists and the cooperative movements of the early 20th century. We go into the story of Nicholas Roerich, the painter, and his wife, Helena Roerich, and theosophy that connected both East and West, and their virtual teacher, Master Moria, an entity that they believed that they channeled. This gets us to Henry Wallace and his crazy ideas that he could centrally dictate agricultural policies. This led to the slaughter of 6 million pigs in 1933. We talk about the influence that Roerich, Wallace, and the dark side of Tibetan Buddhism had on FDR and his New Deal. This is at the same time when the all-seeing eye in the pyramid ends up as the reverse seal on the dollar bill. It's all very much connected. Stay with us and continue to listen to the second hour at redicemembers.com. When you sign up for a membership, you can stream or download. And also, if you subscribe to our members' RSS feeds, you can get all the shows to iTunes, to your mobile device using a podcast app. We have a great FAQ and help section on redicemembers.com that gives you all the details, whether you are on a smartphone, PC, Mac, or a Kindle, iPad, what have you. Mark McCandlish, Frank Myers, Dan Parks, Petter Amundsen, Asharia S, a.k.a. DM Murdoch, are some of our upcoming guests. We'll be back in just a few days with more, but of course, if you want more right now, join us in the second hour and we'll pick up right now. Thank you for listening.